The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at nsa.edu.
There's no real understanding of modern politics that is possible that does not take into full account the deep and pervasive presence of envy. And such a broad cultural understanding will not come about until there's a reformation in the church, and my current suspicion that it will have to be the kind of reformation that would make the Great Awakening look like a 15-minute award ceremony for the Sunday school classes of Fourth Memorial somewhere in Topeka. In other words, this is going to have to be a massive reformation and revival involving hundreds of millions of people in order to address this problem. A European proverb tells the story. If envy were an illness, the world would be a hospital. And not a very good hospital either, because not very many people are getting well. Not many people are going home. So here's your political litmus test. I'm not talking about a couple of girls in junior high where one of them envies the other's grades or looks or boyfriend, although that's an example of envy. I'm talking about the institutionalization of envy that we have allowed to take root in our political structures. So here's a political litmus test. Regardless of real amounts, would you rather have the whole population, everybody, have the same basic income that they have now, give or take 5%? Or would you want 75% of the people to have twice that amount and 25% to have 10 times that amount? Which would be your preference? So everybody could stay roughly where they are, right, give or take. Or you could take 75% of the people and double their wealth in real purchasing power, in tangible goods. Their life would be twice as good, right? If you had a button in front of you, and if you push that button, 75% of the people would have their wealth double overnight, but 25% of the people would have their wealth multiplied by 10. Okay, in other words, the income gap would increase. Everybody's wages would go up, but the gap between rich and what we called poor would be a bigger gap than it was before. If it's the former, if you want everybody to stay the same, then whether or not you are, your worldview is riddled with envy, and repentance of some sort is in order. If the latter, it is also important to remember that this discrepancy of income is not a problem to be solved, but rather is a description of the solution to the equally distributed miseries created by the levelers and haters who insist on the first option. In other words, if I have all my needs met, if I have a roof over my head, if I have food to eat, if I have, you know, a livelihood, if I've got my life, it is not a problem for me that someone else in the world is rich. That's not my problem, not my circus, not my monkeys. So Reagan once said that socialism would only work in two places, in heaven, where they don't need it, and in hell, where they already have it. So the thing that we, in order to bring this reality home, we have to consider the nature of real poverty, what real poverty is like. We all know that envy is a sin, and the Bible rejects it in a number of places. And some people might say, yes, but it's all very well and good to teach against envy, but what about the fact that people are starving, and what about that? So we should remember what we covered in an earlier podcast, the biblical basis for rejecting and hating the sin of envy. We start with that. We have to hate envy. We should be ruthless with ourselves and our possible motives when it comes to those areas where rationalization is likely. Just to spell it out, getting free goods and services is an area where rationalization is likely, right? If someone is running for president and he's running on the platform of free chocolate milk for everybody, then my motives for supporting him might be contaminated because I might really like chocolate milk. Socialism is such a bad idea that the adoption of it can only happen through an appeal to sin. It's such a bad idea that the only way to make it go is to have the engine of envy hooked up to it somehow. The kind of sin that makes socialism appealing would include envy, self-pity, laziness, ingratitude, faux compassion, and self-justification. So, for example, let's take envy and self-pity. We, all of us, live in the midst of incredible wealth. No people in the history of the world have been as blessed as we are. Looking at a bell curve, this includes those on the second quartile from the bottom, the lower middle class. In Western cultures, the lower middle class here are better, are wealthier than the vast majority of people who've ever lived. And this also includes a host of people in the lowest quartile. These people are doing really well, far better than most people in the world today, and much better than most people who've ever lived to date, including Nebuchadnezzar, who didn't have an iPhone, right? Or a car, or a car with air conditioning, or a radio. He didn't have any of that stuff. He didn't have hot and cold running water. He didn't have a shower. So at the same time, these people who are doing really well also live in close proximity to those who are doing really, really, really well, and with shouting distance of those who are doing really, 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 really well, the 1%, what we call the 1%. We say there's a 1%. Well, those hoity-toity 1%ers up there, they're just swanking around. But when you look at the world, when you look at the global situation, everybody in North America is in the 1%, virtually, right? And so people are being encouraged to think of themselves as poor, which is kind of true after a fashion. But it is comparative poverty, relative poverty. And this means that the verses that we cite on our self-pitying behalf don't mean what we think they do. There's a difference between relative poverty and absolute poverty. So let me break this down. Remember that the U.S. Census Bureau classifies a number of Americans in our lower echelons as poor. So our Census Bureau says these are the poor Americans. 62% of these folks, poor people, have satellite or cable. 97% of them have a color television. Over half of them have two or more of them. And notice that I said color television. I'm not sure it's even possible anymore to buy a black and white television. When I was a kid, there were black and white televisions for the middle class and then color televisions for the upper middle class. But now everything's a color television. So over half of them have two or more of them. Almost three quarters of poor people own a car, while 30% own two cars or more. 76% of our poor households have air conditioning. 76% have air conditioning. 46% own their own homes. The homes they own, on average, have three bedrooms, 1.5 baths, a garage, and a porch or patio. The average poor American has more square footage than the average person, not poor person, but the average person who lives in Paris, London, Vienna, or Athens. Only 6% of our poor people live in overcrowded conditions, while more than two-thirds of them have more than two rooms per person. 73% have a microwave oven. More than half have a stereo, and a third have an automatic dishwasher. All right, so got the picture? The source of all this, if you want to pursue it, is a great little book called Money, Greed, and God by Jay Richards. All right, so if you look at page 87 and following, he has the breakdown. Basically, our poor people are not poor. Our poor people are poor compared to other people in the same town, other people on the same continent, but they are not poor in absolute terms. Now, compare this to real poverty, absolute poverty. 50,000 people die every day of poverty-related causes in the world, 50,000 a day. Since 1990, that has tallied up to 270 million people who have died because they were poor. Not died in the condition of poverty, but died because they were poor. 10 million children a year die of hunger or treatable diseases, 10 million a year. 800 million people go to bed hungry every day. Over a billion people in the world live on less than a dollar a day. James 2, 15 and 16 is talking about people in this category and not most of the people in the previous category. Most of the people in the previous category did not meet the conditions of biblical poverty. Biblical poverty is real poverty, grinding poverty, the kind of person who's living in a cardboard box in a landfill outside Manila. That person's poor. Now, it's not surprising that we've gotten ourselves confused. Okay? We use the same noun, poverty, to describe the condition of people in these respective states. But the confusion is not just over the definition of a word. This is a confusion that causes real, tangible damage. Instead of responding with gratitude, the antidote for every form of envy, remember, we're fighting envy, and the antidote to envy is gratitude. Instead of responding with gratitude for all that God has given us and seeking to export the gospel preconditions of the economic system that made this possible to those who desperately need it, we have taken to whining about our comparative disadvantages and doing so in a way calculated to bring third world economic expertise over here. And having behaved this way for a generation or two, we are getting our wish. Obama, during his tenure, was spending us into the poorhouse. And this is not really disputable if you take the trouble to count. And this is another testimony to the enslaving power of sin. The issue is sin, bad attitudes, envy, and ingratitude, and not the presence or absence of resources. If a people are ungrateful to God, they will do poorly over the long haul. If they are grateful to God, they will do well. We here in America are refusing to be grateful. Our health system, the best in the world, is dogmatically declared to be broken. Come with me to Haiti. I'll show you broken. So let's cash this out. We are not talking about various forms of petty thievery, larceny in the heart, on the individual level. The collective effect of this is spectacular grand larceny on a national scale, followed by a national crash. But on the individual level, the pending flood just looks like a raindrop. Now, to be crystal clear, that larceny does not exist in the hearts of those who recognize all this for what it is and who are doing their level best to keep from taking undue advantage. Go back to when our kids, my daughter and son-in-law and my grandkids, some of our grandkids spent some time in the UK while he was studying at Oxford. If they got over to the UK and they thought something like, hey, while we're over here, let's load up on all the free benefits. That would be an individual manifestation of a corporate problem. But if they used the system when they had to, recognized it for what it was, and tried honestly to minimize their need for it, they're just doing what they have to do. So, take another example. Two men are laid off. Both take their unemployment. One of them begins looking for work the first day and goes off unemployment 3 weeks later when he finds a job. The other guy makes sure that he takes the maximum time allowed and gets a job the day after his benefits expire. He's done this multiple times and he has it down to a science. Now, I would argue in both cases, unemployment is a bad idea. Unemployment offers perverse incentives to both, but one of them is refusing those incentives. Our unemployment system as it now exists is not a true insurance program. If it were being run by a private company, that company would be bankrupt. But if it were a private company, it wouldn't be bankrupt because of the people like the first guy. This is another way of saying that public unemployment insurance is not losing money because of the first guy. I can hear all the whatabouts now. What about a diligent guy pounding the sidewalks every day looking for work, but he fails to get work for the entire period that his unemployment lasts? What about him? He shouldn't tie himself in knots over it. It's like breaking your leg in the UK. You know. Right? Not the best plan, but the providence of God is usually something you should roll with. If you break your leg in the UK, I don't think you should go down and they take you to the hospital. I don't think you should refuse treatment because of socialized medicine. You play cards with the hand that you're dealt. But larceny does exist in the hearts of those who have come to think of these entitlements as their right. Among Christians, this larceny is usually petty larceny and is usually accompanied by the sin of grumbling. People who filch things from their boss, for example, almost always do so in a context of grievances, and grievances are usually born of ingratitude. Almost no one wakes up in the morning and thinks, My boss has always treated me in a world-class fashion. I think I'll rob him blind today. No, a man is rationalizing. Mankind is a rationalizing, self-justifying little creature. If we are going to steal something, particularly something little, we tend to tie it up in the bubble wrap of our grumbles. Management hasn't treated me right. The church doesn't do that. The Christians who knew I was hurting didn't help me out when I needed it. The conservatives who told me to get a job just don't understand. Don't you understand? They owe me. And who are they? Oh, I don't know. That mysterious benefactor who funds all this with his magic dollars. Sure, he's paying something, and I'm pretty sure he owes me way more than that. Because I am put upon, the system owes me something. And this opinion is reinforced and stoked by our envy-ridden culture in countless ways. And if someone questions it, they are not just questioning a math problem. They are questioning an entire complex of self-rationalizing conceits. And that explains the reaction.
New St. Andrew's College thanks you for listening.